This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. 2 years ago, Alabama's Chief Justice, Roy Moore, had a monument installed in the rotunda of the State Judicial Building, a 2.5-ton granite representation of the Ten Commandments. Judge Moore says it represents the moral foundation of our legal system. A federal court says it's an unconstitutional establishment of religion and ordered it removed by Wednesday. Judge Moore is defying the federal judge. The case is headed to the Supreme Court. This fight makes Alabama just the latest battleground in an ongoing cultural war. What role should religion play in public life? If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a phone call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now from his offices in Montgomery's Judicial Building is Chief Justice Roy Moore. And good afternoon. Very good of you to be with us.
Good afternoon, Neil. Very good of you to ask me.
You've been quoted as saying as part of the reason that you had this monument installed was in response to declining moral values due to previous court rulings on prayer in public schools. What is this really all about?
It's really all about the monument just simply recognizes the acknowledgement of God from which our morality springs and which is required by the Alabama Constitution in its preamble.
It's required by the Constitution?
Sure. The preamble of the Constitution of Alabama says, we the people of the state of Alabama, in order to establish justice, it goes on to say, invoke the favor and guidance of Almighty God. To recognize the basis of our justice system, which is my duty as Chief Justice of Alabama, I must recognize the basis of that justice system, which is in God.
Part of your argument, as I understand it, was based on states' rights, and the federal appellate court compared that to the stand of the late governor of Alabama, George Wallace, who defied federally court-ordered desegregation. Is that comparison apt?
No, it's not. It whatsoever. What Wallace did and what this is doing is completely opposite. What Wallace did was to divide people. This is something that would unite people. We're not denying rights, as Wallace did. We're recognizing the source of those rights as recognized in the organic law of this country, which is the Declaration of Independence. It's a completely different situation. I think that the attempt by certain to put it in that kind of context is simply to distort the true issue in this case, which is what the judge said it was in his closing argument before the court. He said, the issue is, can the state acknowledge God? And we simply say that no judge can tell you that you cannot acknowledge God. And as a state, they can tell the state that they can't acknowledge God when it's in the Constitution.
Why is the Ten Commandments the best or the only way, if you would, to recognize God in justice?
It's not the only way. There are many ways to recognize God in justice. We do it in the national law, for example, the Pledge of Allegiance. One nation under God, indivisible with liberty and justice for all. We recognize it in our national law. It's not the only way to recognize it. It's just one way.
Mm-hmm. And those who take offense at this and say they feel that this is an imposition, the state establishing one religion over another. How do you respond to that?
Well, first, you know, because somebody is offended at something, doesn't make it unconstitutional. We're not a constitution that's governed by feelings of individuals. We're governed by law. That law is the First Amendment of the United States Constitution, which says Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. And to enforce that law, to recognize what that law means, indeed to interpret that law, we must know what the words mean according to the forefathers that wrote the amendment. Religion wasn't God. There was a distinction between God and the institution of religion. That was recognized as late as 1954 when it said that a distinction must be made between the existence of religion as an institution and a belief in the sovereignty of God. That was the national law legislative history under the Pledge of Allegiance in 1954.
Yeah.
So we've got to make a distinction of what we're talking about. We're not talking about religion. We're talking about God, and there's a distinction.
We are, as you say,
the First Amendment.
Yeah, we are, as you say, a nation of laws. The federal court has ordered this to be removed, and yet you're defying that order.
Well, exactly. We are a nation of laws, not of men. And this is what this judge in this federal court has completely ignored. He's completely ignored the meaning of the words in the First Amendment, and he's issued his ruling on the way he feels about something. Now, to make that perfectly clear to you, Neil, it's not my words that he's ignored the law. He said himself that he didn't have the expertise to define the word religion in the First Amendment. And he said further, it's dangerous and unwise to define the word. Now, if somebody says it's dangerous and unwise to define a word and they're interpreting a statute, do you think they're ruling according to the law? Absolutely not. They're ruling according to how they feel about something.
Yet the appellate court agreed with him.
The appellate court came back and tried to define religion and completely ignored the word law. In fact, on the 11th Circuit Appeals Court asked the question during oral argument, if we were asserting that this was a law, or if we were saying that it couldn't be removed because it wasn't a law. Well, of course it's not a law. Just because the Chief Justice puts a desk in the rotunda or a picture on the wall or a monument in the building doesn't make it a law. It's nothing somebody has to abide by or, doesn't let them do anything. It commands no obedience or neither restricts their actions. It's simply not a law. It's a monument. And it doesn't fit the First Amendment definition.
If the penalty of the court, as I understand it, is $5,000 per day while this is not removed, and the case is, as I understand it, going to be pursued up to the Supreme Court,
yes.
What if you lose there?
Well, I mean, if we lose there, we'll take that step as we get to it, Neil. But we have filed before the United States Supreme Court a writ of prohibition to say that this order is void and should be held for naught, and that we've asked for a stay before the district court, and we'll ask for one before the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals before the Wednesday deadline.
Before the Wednesday deadline. So you're looking for relief before those fines set in.
Well, I think that we have to do the legal and appropriate legal thing to do, of course. And, you know, no one likes to face fines by a federal court, but the point is the federal court has no jurisdiction here, no power or authority here, and to levy fines is even an exacerbation of that proposition.
I just want clarification. The federal court has no jurisdiction in this case, or I'm sure you don't mean in the state of Alabama.
No, I'm saying the federal court has no jurisdiction in this issue.
I see. I just want to clarify.
Yeah, not in the state of Alabama, of course. We recognize that we've got numerous federal courts in the state. But in this issue, which deals with the state constitution and my oath to uphold the judicial system, which is established on invoking favor and guidance of Almighty God, a federal judge simply can't tell us we can't recognize who God is.
Justice Moore, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Neil, and appreciate you having me on.
Chief Justice Roy Moore of the Alabama Supreme Court joined us today from his office in Montgomery, Alabama. And with us now is NPR correspondent Debbie Elliott, who's been following this case. She's in Orange Beach, Alabama. Debbie, good of you to be with us.
Hi, thank you, Neil.
Justice Moore has some history on the Ten Commandments. This is not his first controversy.
Oh, no, it isn't. In fact, Judge Moore became nationally known as the Ten Commandments judge even before he was elected Chief Justice of the Alabama Supreme Court. Back in the mid-90s, he was a circuit judge in Gadsden, Alabama, and he would open his court with prayer every day, and he had a small wooden hand-carved plaque of the Ten Commandments posted on his courtroom wall. He was sued over that by the ACLU in the mid-90s, and there was a prolonged court battle, and he became famous for defying a court order, not taking that plaque off of his wall. He used that notoriety to propel himself into the Chief Justice of the Alabama Supreme Court seat, promising when he ran, you know, this would be his issue, that he would bring the Ten Commandments to the Supreme Court.
Describe the building and the monument that he's had placed there in the rotunda.
It's a fairly new building. In downtown Montgomery, where all of the other state offices are, it's called the Alabama Judicial Building. It houses the Supreme Court as well as other state appeals court, the Alabama Court of Criminal Appeals, for example. And when you walk in the door, you go through security, and you enter a small rotunda in the back of the building. And that's where he has placed this huge granite monument. It's gray, about the size of a washing machine. It's cordoned off by the kind of ropes that you maybe go through in a movie theater.
Mm-hmm.
And on the top of this monument are two tablets, and that's where the Ten Commandments are inscribed. And then all around the sides of the monument are various other quotes that relate to God and the law.
Is it all Ten Commandments, keeping the
yes.
Sabbath and everything?
Every one of them, numbered 1 through 10.
Okay. Now, there is, as I think I mentioned during the conversation with Judge Moore, a court order that says it should be removed by August 20th, which is Wednesday.
This Wednesday. Basically, after the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that Judge Myron Thompson in Montgomery was right, the federal district judge that said Judge Moore must remove it because it violates the Establishment of Religion Clause in the U.S. Constitution, Judge Thompson held a conference call with the lawyers in the case and said, okay, what we have to do now is I issued a stay for you to appeal this. You've appealed it to the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, and they've rejected your appeal. It's time to move it. And he gave the judge until this Wednesday to remove it, said after that he's going to start imposing fines on the state of Alabama of $5,000 a day. And he hinted that should that not work after a few days, that fine may go up.
Justice Moore is not the only judge on the Alabama Supreme Court. What are the other justices saying?
That's very interesting. In fact, when Judge Moore installed this monument a couple of years ago, he did so in the middle of the night without consulting his other judges on the Supreme Court. And a few of them spoke out at the time that they thought it was inappropriate. Now they have held a meeting last week, and I understand they're going to be meeting again this week, to discuss whether or not they have any jurisdiction to intervene in this case or to maybe remove the monument themselves. I think they're trying to decide if a majority of the other justices on the Alabama Supreme Court can somehow override this so-called administrative action by the Chief Justice and remove the monument, whether he does so or not, in order to comply with the judge's order.
There are obviously also other elected officials in the state of Alabama, and where are they coming down on the issue? The fine, of course, would be on the state of Alabama, not on Judge Moore himself.
It's been interesting. Most have been somewhat quiet about this. You have to remember that Judge Moore is very popular in the state of Alabama, and he has a lot of support for what he's doing. So it would be difficult for another elected official to come out and defy him. Governor Riley, the governor of the state of Alabama, who is also a Republican, has said, you know, he's staying out of it, that there's nothing he can do to resolve it, and that, you know, he's not going to tell Judge Moore whether or not he should comply with the federal court order. So it'll be interesting to see if that position stays the same once the bills start adding up for the state, because I don't know if you know or not, but Alabama is in a financial bind right now, facing about a $675 million budget deficit. So $5,000 a day could really add up for the state.
Anything likely to happen on Wednesday?
Well, I think so. A lot of supporters for Judge Moore have said they plan to be in Montgomery to kneel around the monument in an act of civil disobedience to make sure that nothing happens and that monument is not removed. So I do think that it'll be interesting to see what happens Wednesday and how people react. They've likened it to Martin Luther King's actions in Alabama during the civil rights movement. They say they'll be there at 12:01 on the 20th. To protect the monument, and even if federal marshals come in, they don't plan on moving.
Yet we just have a few seconds left, have you? There's no prospect of federal marshals coming in on Wednesday anyway.
Not right now. Judge Thompson said he was going to use the fine and see what happened with that before he moved to other options.
Thanks very much.
Sure. Thank you, Neil.
NPR correspondent Debbie Elliott in Orange Beach, Alabama. Obviously, we'll be hearing reports from her on what happens in this case on Wednesday. When we come back from a break, we'll talk more about the Alabama Ten Commandments case and the struggle to define the separation of church and state. Our phone number, if you'd like to join the conversation, is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address, totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing the controversy over the Ten Commandments monument in Alabama's state courthouse and the larger questions it raises about the place of religion in civil society. How do you make the distinction? If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255 or send us email totn@npr.org. Earlier, we heard from Alabama Chief Justice Roy Moore, who placed the granite monument in the courthouse rotunda a couple of years ago and is now threatening to defy a federal court order to remove it. Joining us now is the Reverend Barry Lynn, Executive Director of Americans United for Separation of Church and State. His organization is one of the groups that brought the lawsuit against Judge Moore. He joins us now from San Diego, California, and it's good to have you on Talk of the Nation.
It's nice to be here, Neil.
What is wrong with the placement of this monument to the Ten Commandments in the rotunda of the state courthouse?
Well, frankly, here is a judge who has decided that he effectively owns the courthouse and treats it as his own private property. He's erected a 2.5-ton granite monument with one version of the Ten Commandments. It has become virtually a religious shrine. People literally come there and pray there and kneel there. And the message that he sends by having this dramatic presentation of the faith of some people in Alabama is to make everyone else feel like a second-class citizen if they have a different religious viewpoint or no religious viewpoint at all, but they still need to do business in the middle of that state's most important courthouse.
As Judge Moore mentioned, there is certain citations of the deity in the Alabama Constitution. In God We Trust is on the dollar bills. A picture of Moses the lawgiver is on the frieze of the United States Supreme Court. What's the difference?
Well, the big difference is that this gentleman has decided to do this a little over 2 years ago under cover of darkness, which is, of course, always a bad sign that maybe you're not doing the right thing. The Alabama preamble to the Constitution has no legal relevance in this case. As an attorney also, I can tell you that I've heard strange legal arguments, but the ones he makes are the ones truly on the fringe of the law. He does have to obey court orders, federal court orders interpreting the First Amendment. His lawyers have tried to argue contrary. They're not going to get anywhere with that argument, and in fact, their defiant stand before the Supreme Court, they've been filing various complicated writs to order things to happen or not to happen, but in pronouncing in advance that they really don't care what the federal courts say because they're not going to abide by their decisions anyway, I think it's a real insult to the Supreme Court, and it guarantees that the Supreme Court will never hear this case, nor should it, frankly, because it should be over. It's done. This is a violation, if I ever saw one, of the separation of church and state. It's not even a close question, and I think the judge in his heart's got to know that.
Let's get some listeners involved. We have a call from John, who's on the line with us from Washington, D.C.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I am not an attorney, but I do believe that Judge Moore is right in his stance for two reasons, one theological and one legal. Theologically speaking, Judge Moore, who is a devout Christian, is commanded by Scripture to render to Caesar those things that are Caesar's. What that means is that he is not attempting to establish some sort of theocratic rule in his court. Any case that comes before his bench must be adjudicated according to Alabama state law. He is, as a member of the Alabama State Bar and also as a Christian, he is absolutely under the thumb, so to speak, to do such. So to say that he is imposing his theological beliefs on someone else is factually incorrect.
Well, let's get a response from Barry Lynn. Where does the imposition of religion come in this case, in your opinion?
Well, if you take a look at this thing, which is, as I said, 2.5-ton monument to the Ten Commandments, it is such an overwhelming symbol of the religious character that Judge Roy Moore wants to bring to his courtroom that it has a very practical and intimidating effect. That is to say, if you don't believe as he believes, you literally, you're sent a very strong message that you do not belong in that court. And John's call here, of course, the Supreme Court talks about the law, the Bible talks about Scripture, but I don't know in either case where Judge Moore gets the idea that it is his obligation to take not his private space, this is not his private office or his private home or his private front yard, but to take this, which owns this piece of the building, building owned by everyone in the state of Alabama and turn it into a religious shrine. Now, that's not required by the Bible, and it's not permitted by the Constitution. That's two strikes, and I think this, the third strike is when he starts having to pay a fine if he acts in defiance of this court order starting on Wednesday.
Again, the fine would be against the state and not against him personally. John, you had another point?
Yes, if I may, as a follow-up. Yeah, I'm sure that your guest most of your listeners may not know, but your guest has had numerous conversations with people such as Jay Sekulow from the American Center of Law and Justice. This is an old, old argument. You know, if you look at the writings of the Founding Fathers and you look at all of the documents that preceded the formation of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, it is extremely clear that although the Founding Fathers were not all Christians, in fact, some were atheists, some were deists, it is very, very clear that most of them at some point or another actually, I was temporarily distracted, gave some sort of reference to providence, which, of course, if you know the language at the time, that's referring to God. The Senate today has a chaplain. Prayers are still used in the Congress. And if you look at all of the documents that the Founding Fathers wrote, Congress was opened up each day with hours of prayer. I mean, this is not something new. This is not some, you know, hard right-wing fundamentalist thing. This is how our country was founded.
Mm-hmm. And this is not how the country was founded. Some of what you say is correct. Of course, things like "In God We Trust" didn't appear on the coins until after the Civil War, and then only on the 2-cent piece. And some of this history that you're reciting is accurate. Some of it, a lot of it, is wrong. But the point is, this is where the courts need to draw lines. As you know, even if you're not a lawyer, you know the courts need to draw lines. Laws are made because some things are on the legal side and some on the illegal side. Legislatures do that all the time. And when you have a 2.5-ton monument that was placed here 2 years ago, you don't have the benefit of history. You only have the benefit of the arrogance of a judge. I don't know. I'm not here to discuss really his deeper lack of depth as religious commitments. I assume that they're deep commitments. I also assume, though, that he made an oath, took an oath to defend the U.S. Constitution as well as the other laws, and that he's in violation of it at the moment, or will be, I should say, on Wednesday, if he doesn't remove this, which he could easily do, take it to a church, treat it with reverence, put it on the church lawn, and everyone would be better served.
Reverend Barry Lynn, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Barry Lynn is Executive Director of Americans United for Separation of Church and State, and he was with us from San Diego in California. At the root is this case is a battle of values. Two parties in the culture wars. Join us now, Robert Kuttner, co-editor of the American Prospect magazine. He's with us from his office in Boston, Massachusetts. Hello, Bob.
Hi there.
And Matthew Spaulding, director of the B. Kenneth Simon Center for American Studies at the Heritage Foundation. He's in their studio in downtown Washington, and it's good of you to be with us today.
Good to be with you as well.
How important is this fight to those who feel society has gotten too secular, Matthew Spaulding?
Oh, I think this is an extremely important case, regardless of the outcome, precisely because it touches upon something which has been going on for some time, which is a long-term discussion, a battle, if you would use that term. I would send a discussion about the nature of religion in the United States, and we've seen it really coming up through a series of court cases going back to the 1940s. To what extent does establishment mean? Remember, Congress can't do that. The court has expanded that to the states. What does establishment mean? Does this violate that concept? And thus, do other references, such as those on our currency, on our coins, and other places, are those violations as well, and thus unconstitutional? This is really at the edge of that debate, if you will, in the same way that, say, the Pledge of Allegiance case is in the Ninth Circuit. These kinds of cases, although somewhat murky in some of its particulars, are extremely important in defining that larger argument.
Bob Kuttner, would you agree?
Well, I think they are very important, and I think the United States has done very well as a deeply religious country by separating church and state. When you compare the United States to countries that do have official religions, we have a much higher proportion of the population who believe in God. We have a much higher proportion of the population who regularly attend church or synagogue or mosque. precisely because the state stays out of the church's business. And, of course, what's often forgotten is that when Jefferson and the other founders, in their wisdom, separated church from state, it was not to discourage religious observance. It was precisely to protect church from state. And this was in the aftermath of 150 years of religious wars. Don't forget, this country was founded by people who were refugees from the principle that governed in Europe, that the king decided what religion you had to practice. These were religious minorities, and that's why the founders were so concerned to make sure that the state did not interfere with anybody's right to practice his or her own private religion. And so that's why it's terribly important to keep alive this doctrine of separation of church and state, and to recognize that we're on a slippery slope. It may be that 90% plus of people in America view the tablets of the Ten Commandments as an unobjectionable, if not a sacred document, but there are people who don't. And the whole point is to say it's none of the state's business how people practice their religion, and in that context, religion thrives.
Matthew Spaulding, is this case representative of a feeling among some people that it's not religion that's being imposed on them, but secularism that's being imposed on them?
Well, I would actually agree with about half of what was just said. The problem is that there's a perception, and I think that one can make a strong argument in this case, that the separation of church and state, especially in the second half of the 20th century, has gone well beyond what it was intended to establish. I fundamentally agree on the importance of separating church and state in terms of church doctrine and state laws. But in terms of separating to great detail all religion and all politics in the way that this seems to be doing and other cases like this, I think goes against the separation of church and state. There's a certain mixing that went on prior to that, separation at one level, but a certain mixing at another level. And the question is whether majorities, in this case the state of Alabama, can make certain decisions such as this, which display a certain recognition of the importance of religion in our history and culture in a way that really isn't offensive but represents the majority opinion. If that kind of majority opinion can't stand and falls to every challenge, I think we've got a much deeper problem in maintaining not only the separation of church and state, but Republican government.
Let's get a phone call. John joins us now on the line from Los Angeles.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. My question is, I guess, as follows. Does displaying the Ten Commandments in that Alabama courthouse imply that followers of Judeo-Christianity will get a preferential treatment for the justice that is meted out there?
So that's favoring one specific religion, is what you're saying?
Yeah.
Yeah. Bob Kuttner?
Well, sure. I mean, even though the vast majority of Americans may view that as a sacred document or scriptural concept that they endorse, everyone in America is not a Jew or a Christian. And I don't know why religion is so feeble that it needs government to intervene on its side. Government should be neutral as between religion and non-religion, and it should be neutral among religions, and this piece of granite violates both of those doctrines.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. John, thanks very much for the phone call.
Listen to Pacifica.
Okay, John, bye-bye. Let's get a call now from Steve, who's with us from Sacramento, California.
Hello.
Hi.
I just wanted to comment that I don't believe that this individual case should be viewed as an establishment of religion issue, but it's more of a historic recognition of the foundation for our legal system, and recognize that you know, the English law that our legal system is based on was based on the Judeo-Christian legal system and the Ten Commandments itself.
Matthew Spaulding, is this religious? Judge Moore certainly says it is.
Well, I think that the specific question is whether this is a religious establishment case. And I think there that the caller is correct. This doesn't formally establish a religion. There's nothing here that says that one will get through the court doors faster by professing faith. There's no test here. But I think what is at issue here is historically in America, there is always a notion that religion did play some sort of role in our founding and in our history. And whether that can be recognized in some way, I think, is the nub of the issue. It doesn't necessarily imply that. Let me put it this way: the argument that everything must be removed to satisfy these rights questions, I think, turns it around such that you're completely cleansing out of our history any religious references, which is to impose another form of religion, namely radical neutrality or secularism.
Mm-hmm. Can I just comment on that?
Yeah, go ahead.
The problem you get into is which religion. And the period in which the First Amendment was written, separating church and state, was a period where the memories were very fresh of Mary Dyer being hanged in Boston because she was a Quaker, or Roger Williams being expelled from the Massachusetts Bay Colony because he believed that you didn't have to be a Christian to do the business of the state. And it's a very, very slippery slope. And the Ten Commandments, even though in the Judeo-Christian tradition they're close to universal, are not completely universal. The problem comes when the state embraces a particular religion, and even though the founders were almost all religious believers, it's almost impossible for the state to embrace the idea of religion or God without embracing a particular religion. That's why it's such a slippery slope.
I agree with that. That's why the key to the separation of church and state is non-sectarianism.
Well, why not construct a mosque instead?
The problem is that the alternative, which seems to be being pushed, is that nothing is the alternative, and thus you take out of our culture and history, I think, a very rich contribution that's brought to the table by religion. And I think that kind of what is perceived as a form of radicalism, I think is what is really making a lot of people very uncomfortable with the other side of this argument.
But see, what I don't understand is why people who are libertarians in every other respect, libertarian meaning that the government should stay out of things, suddenly become statists when the issue is the government preaching religion.
That's a good question, but you should ask a libertarian. I think that kind of radical individualism, I think, is not the correct understanding of the American founders as well. There was a very delicate balance, and here I completely agree. It's very complicated and hard to find, but there was a balance between the free exercise of religion, which we wanted to encourage and see thrive in this country, and the keeping it out of government, which
you,
I agree
you
with
truly
as well.
You agree that the Ten Commandments is a specific religious symbol. If that were a mosque, a majority of Alabamians would have a very different view of it.
Well, I think Alabamians should be able to decide that question.
And we'll continue to discuss it when we come back from a short break. And again, if you'd like to join our conversation, the phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-8255. And TOTN@NPR.org if you'd like to send us email. More with Matthew Spaulding and Robert Kuttner in just a moment. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing the place that religious expression should have in civil society. What purpose does it serve? Where do you draw the lines? Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. Our guests are Matthew Spaulding of the Heritage Foundation and Robert Kuttner, who's co-editor of the American Prospect magazine. And let's get back to another phone call. And Sarah joins us on the line from Belmont, Massachusetts.
Hello?
Hello.
Hi. The point I wanted to make was that the reference to the God in the Ten Commandments is to a very specific God, because it says, I am the eternal, your God, who took you out of the land of Mitzrayim, out of the house of slavery. And what about people who are Buddhists or Hindus or Zoroastrians, and their God or gods, you know, was never involved in the rescue operation out of Egypt? So, mm-hmm. I mean, you know, this is it's a very specific God, and I don't see how this can be held to be a universal God or universal principle.
As distinct from the In God We Trust on the dollar bill. Matthew Spaulding?
Right.
No, I think that's a very good question. We might ask the same thing about the statue of Moses and the Ten Commandments in the back of the Supreme Court building. The point is, I think that this is not a question of claiming. I think perhaps Judge Moore makes this argument, but I don't. It's not a matter of claiming that the Ten Commandments do represent universal principles and therefore are applicable in its exactitude. I think the point is that historically the United States, from its very beginning, does have a heritage broadly defined as Judeo-Christian. And in that sense, this a monument like this or other references on our coins and elsewhere, especially in the context of our other documents, such as the Declaration of Independence, I think are not establishments and thus are not unconstitutional in the specific sense it's being debated here today.
Robert Kuttner, as mentioned earlier, I don't think Moses is the only lawgiver represented at the U.S. Supreme Court.
No, that's correct.
Well, The difficulty is that if you listen to Judge Moore, or if you read Judge Moore, he's not putting up this monument or this piece of granite out of historical recognition. He's doing it as a devout Christian. An earlier caller referred to the earlier history of English law. Well, England has an established state religion, the Anglican Church. The founders very wisely broke with that tradition when they decided that on this side of the Atlantic, we were going to separate church and state. It's very interesting that in England, which has an established church, religious belief is just about withered, and in this country, where there's all this concern by people of faith about secularism, religious belief is flourishing. So I don't know why you need the state to go back on what the founders very wisely did and get into the business of promoting religion. Religion can take care of itself, and it can take care of itself better if the state stays out of its business.
Sarah, thanks very much for the phone call.
Thank you.
And let's see if we get one more caller in on this question. Doug is with us from Laramie, Wyoming.
Yeah. I was wondering, in removing all religious symbols and references, we end up, the state ends up representing atheism, which in a sense is a religious or theological point of view. I mean, whether it's atheistic or not, it looks that way.
Hmm. Bob Kuttner?
Well, don't forget, I mean, we do have a Pledge of Allegiance under God, one nation under God. We do have In God We Trust on the coins. The Declaration of Independence talks about all men are created equal and are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights. I think it would be very hard to claim that the United States of America is pro-atheism.
Well, and the other side of it is I extend a franchise to the state, being this is a representative democracy, and then somehow they represent maybe an arbitrary point of view separate from mine, and I can see the judge in Alabama's point of view. You know, this is something that he feels strongly about, as you said, and something that he wants represented in his state as it's representing him.
He's not a private citizen. He's acting with the majesty of the power of the Supreme Court of the state of Alabama as a public official. That's different from you or I deciding to erect a tablet of the Ten Commandments on our lawn.
Matthew Spaulding, I'm going to give you the last word on this.
No, I agree with the significance of what is going on down in Alabama. I think it does come back to this general question, however. We want to have separation of church and state, but the current court wants to construct a wall that's very high and impregnable, and I think it's just gone too far at this point. We've got to find a way to have a reasonable, balanced way to eke out the existence of religious recognition that doesn't violate individual rights, but recognizes the very deep and important role religion has played in our civil society.
Doug, thanks very much for the call. And Matthew Spaulding, we thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
Matthew Spaulding, director of the B. Kenneth Simon Center for American Studies at the Heritage Foundation, with us from today from their offices in downtown Washington. And Bob Kuttner, always good to talk to you.
And likewise, Neil.
Bob Kuttner is the co-editor of the American Prospect magazine. He joined us from his office in Boston, Massachusetts.